Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Halper.
I'm Mary Matte. Hey, everybody. Thanks for being here. Our website is usefulidiotspodcast.com. If you go there, you can support the show, keep us going, and in return, you get bonus content.
You get extended interviews. You get something called Thursday Throwdown, which is your midweek dose of media madness. It's just a great time. Give yourself that gift. Do yourself that favor.
All right. Well, let's get to our four basic food groups. I have Democrats suck, and for my Democrats suck, I'm going to turn to something Kamala Harris is apparently very proud of, which is that the endorsements are just pouring in from neocon Republicans. And here she is announcing some of them to join the Kamala train. And Kamala says, I have the endorsement of 200 Republicans who formerly worked with President Bush, Mitt Romney, and John McCain. Look at all those Republicans. One of those Republicans is the former Attorney General under George W. Bush, Alberto Gonzalez, known for covering up torture, known for justifying pretty much anything that George W. Bush wanted to do that was illegal, like including illegal wiretapping.
Yeah, I mean, not just covering up torture. I mean, saying it was legally kosher to do it. I just feel like we should give him full credit.
Now he, because he believes in the rule of law, he is endorsing Kamala Harris. But of course, the biggest get for Kamala was none other than the Dark Lord himself, Dick Cheney.
Chainala for Kamala. That's what they should call the endorsement.
That's a Chainala. It doesn't quite roll off the tongue, but we can work on it. Chainala for Kamala. Well, anyway, here is a supercut put together by a conservative account that is, you know, critical of Kamala Harris. So there's a partisan interest there, but they did put together a useful guide to all the times Cheney was not known as the democracy defender that he's being billed as now for endorsing Kamala, but as the Dark Lord for all the evil he did actually inflict on the world.
I actually have the endorsement of former Vice President Dick Cheney.
Dick Cheney and Satan. That's next.
The Sith Lord is back.
Like a demon, it rises again.
Dick Cheney, Darth Vader, Satan.
Thank you to Satan for giving me inspiration on how to play this role.
We don't need Dick Cheney.
Dick Cheney was dangerous. That war.
The only thing you got to do is just be better than Dick Cheney.
I like to see Dick Cheney do exposed. He's a liar.
So there you go. Dick Cheney goes from being villain number one to hero because he endorses Kamala Harris. Now, one person in media who remembers what liberals used to say about Dick Cheney is Mike Tracy, who's been on our show, and for Glenn Greenwald's show, System Update, he was at the Philadelphia debate between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, and he caught up with some people to ask them, like, hey, remember when like Dick Cheney was your biggest enemy? What happened to that? So here he is questioning, for example, Democratic Congress member Ted Lieu.
Congressman, Kamala Harris tonight touted the endorsement of Dick Cheney. Did you find that at all bizarre? Is Dick Cheney someone who's fit to judge the competence or character of a president? I mean, I'm old enough to remember when Dick Cheney was reviled by Democrats, rightly so, because he was integral in launching the Iraq War on false pretenses.
Dick Cheney is certainly competent to judge the one issue that matters, which is the preservation of our democracy. And look,
why is he fit to judge that?
Because he is supporting Kamala Harris, because she actually supports democracy. Unlike Donald Trump, who you saw tonight, still can't handle the fact that he lost the election. He's willing to upend our democracy, put lies into people's heads that somehow this election was stolen. And look, Republicans and Democrats disagree on various...
Democrats used to accuse Cheney and Bush of stealing the 2000 election. So how is he in a position to make this judgment to the extent that Kamala Harris is going to tout her on a national stage before the biggest audience she's ever spoken to?
Dick Cheney is putting country over a party on the one issue of democracy. So Donald Trump incited an insurrection to try to stop the certification of the Electoral College. I was there on January 6th. I was one of the co-authors of the article of impeachment against Donald Trump because he is a traitor who does not believe in democracy, and he still can't handle the fact that he lost the election. And you cannot be president of the United States if you don't respect the one issue that matters of America, which is our elections and respecting the peaceful transfer of power. That is why Dick Cheney endorsed Kamala Harris. I'm sure he doesn't agree with her on the overwhelming majority of issues, but that one issue is so paramount because it's the fundamental nature of our country. It is our democracy.
By the way, in that clip, Mike Tracy goes on to have a fun exchange with Ted Lieu about whether or not he still thinks that Trump colluded with Russia, if you remember that whole thing. Which is pretty, it's a pretty funny exchange. But yeah, listen, I think we're setting the bar really low. If all it takes to, you know, embrace the word of Dick Cheney is to get him to, you know, oppose Donald Trump, and then somehow that means he's some sort of expert on democracy and cares about the rule of law when he's one of the most flagrant violators of it, arguably in U.S. history.
I mean, it's also really funny because the difference between Dick Cheney and Donald Trump when it comes to preserving democracy is that they both tried to overturn elections and Dick Cheney was successful. That's the difference.
There you go.
January 6th was not successful, but the Brooks Brothers riot and the legal machinations and the purging black voters from voting registration, that was successful.
And maybe that's why they're embracing Dick Cheney's, because he was successful. If he was a loser like Trump, maybe they wouldn't want his blessing in endorsing Kamala Harris.
They were asking if he's competent, right, to judge. He's more of a competent cooer.
And certainly he knows about coups because, let's see, under the Bush administration's watch, who did they try to coup abroad? They definitely overthrew the democratically elected government of Haiti, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Mm-hmm. That was a full-on U.S.-backed coup. Dick Cheney played a big role in that. The Bush administration, after overthrowing Aristide, declared he was no longer welcome in the Western Hemisphere. So that's how entitled Cheney and Bush felt to overthrow democracy, not only to change the government's leader to oust him, but to say he's no longer welcome in the hemisphere. And they also tried to overthrow the president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez. That was successful for a couple of days, but ultimately Chavez and his supporters were able to overcome that and return. So he certainly knows about coups.
He is. I mean, we've made this point before, I think, right? That I actually think that Trump in many ways is less scary than other Republicans because he's less competent.
Certainly not very. Anybody watching that debate the other night, I think, would agree at this point now that Trump is definitely not very competent. But hey, if it can help rebrand Dick Cheney, then some people are apparently all for it.
It's so disgusting. Literally, all you have to be is not Trump, and then you're praised as a defender of democracy.
So yeah, that's your Democrats suck.
So for Republicans suck, let's take a look at what happened between Stephen Miller, who was a Trump advisor and speechwriter and spokesperson and a major architect of Trump's really draconian immigration policies. Let's take a look at what he said about immigration, Venezuela, and something unexpected happens.
The crime rate in Venezuela is down, I believe, a little bit over 60%. Over the last several years.
Are you trusting the official figures from the Venezuelan dictatorship?
Okay, so what's interesting here is that Stephen Miller, who was, by the way, kind of criticized by his own family because they were Jewish refugees and they were ashamed of how anti-immigrant he was. But he's trying to say that the Kamala and Biden are responsible for illegal immigration and dangerous immigration, and all these criminals have come from Venezuela, and now the crime rate in Venezuela is low because they've emptied their jails and sent them here. And he's talking to someone who's not pro Maduro, who actually hates Maduro, as you'll see. But his point is, how can you take those numbers seriously? How can you take the numbers of a dictator seriously? So they agree. They both see Maduro as a villain, but they have kind of different perspectives on the numbers.
If you're a dictator of a poor country with a high crime rate, wouldn't you send your criminals to our open border?
That wasn't my question. Are you trusting the figures of the dictatorships?
I have a question. Who do you think? Answer me this.
My family is from Venezuela. I know very well the situation of Caracas and many other cities.
Right, tell me, no American community.
But I was asking to you about figures, numbers,
what I'm
facts.
To you is the facts are the dead bodies. The facts are.
You said that Caracas has a lowest crime rate than the USA.
The facts are the mutilated bodies. The facts are the people in the morgues that are dead.
I was asking you about Caracas and the numbers in Caracas. Are you trusting the numbers of the dictatorship?
I am trusting the fact that Kamala Harris is letting illegal immigrants into this country who are raping and murdering children. Do you know who Jocelyn Hungary is? Do you know who she is?
Do you know how
Tell
many
who
people
who is she?
Experiencing
who is
violence
she?
In Caracas?
Who is she? Who is Laken Riley?
You now, trust Nicolas Maduro?
I trust that he does not want his criminals to be...
So you believe in his numbers?
I believe he's sending his criminals to our country.
And do you think that the crime rate in Venezuela have decreased?
Do you not believe the law enforcement reports of Venezuelan gangs in this country?
I was asking for the Venezuelan government figures, not the figures here.
So Stephen Miller really has a problem with his temper in that clip.
And you have to wonder, I think it's fair to speculate, given his record, that his frustration is all the more intense because he's speaking to someone with like a Spanish accent, right? Like some, like this immigrant dare questioning me, like you can see the entitlement of his face. I don't know, that's my armchair psychoanalysis, but he also just hates being challenged to begin with.
Yeah.
And I mean, for me, it's a frustrating debate to watch because I mean the premise is that we can't possibly trust anything that Venezuela says, and of course in terms of why migrants are fleeing Venezuela, no one's taking responsibility for the fact that Stephen Miller's administration, Trump administration, designed sanctions deliberately designed to ruin Venezuela's economy, which they were warned about, as we recently learned in the Washington Post, which we covered on the show. And of course, that's missing from the debate. But that aside, it's pretty entertaining to see Stephen Miller get so frustrated.
All right. So what do we have for Isn't That Weird?
For Isn't That Weird, we're going to stay with the theme of immigration because the Republicans are really trying to center that in this campaign. And in the debate with Kamala Harris, Trump tried to do so in part by telling this story about Haitian immigrants eating pets in Springfield, Ohio. And since then, there's been this like, you know, mad chase online from conservatives to find some evidence to back up this ludicrous claim that Trump made. And the one thing concrete that I've seen that they produce is like a video, a police video, of a woman being confronted for allegedly eating a cat or harming a cat. But that woman's not a Haitian immigrant. She's an American citizen who is mentally ill. So that one didn't work. But now we have, this is kind of breaking news, the smoking gun. And here it is.
We've lost a whole bunch of cats. There was a van, a van pulled over that had over 100 cats in it with the Haitians. They said they was eating them.
Actually?
Yeah.
Not fake news.
Not fake news.
So a van was collecting cats and eating them.
I watched it happen, yeah. Watched them get pulled over with the cats and admit to the police that they was eating them.
You're not joshing with me.
No. I'm almost 50 years old, buddy.
You don't mess around.
No.
Well, there it is. Case closed. There were some Haitians in a van with over 100 cats. Bam. Trump vindicated. Let's call the election right now.
Yeah.
But really, this is, I mean, you know, we can laugh at this because, you know, Trump's comment was so silly. But there's a serious side to this, which is that, you know, what is the experience now for a Haitian American, for a Haitian immigrant in this country now, especially in places like Springfield? There's already reports of people being afraid and facing, you know, even more discrimination than normal because this claim being spread. So although there's some levity to this issue, there's also a really serious side where people are going to suffer for it because Trump has a very large audience, obviously, and this thing is spreading wildly, and a lot of people actually do believe it. And the people who are going to suffer for it are the most, you know, marginalized people already, which is Haitian immigrants. So that's just worth keeping in mind.
So for Isn't That Terrible, let's take a look at a new product. Now, I learned about this product because someone on Twitter posted a TikTok video of a woman who says she saw this commercial, a commercial for this product, while watching MSNBC. Let's take a look at this product. I'm not going to introduce it to you. I just want you to see it fresh.
A message from the 45th president of the United Ponds of America.
Let's make fishing great again, okay?
He's here. Everyone's favorite fish, Trumpy Trout.
No one has ever seen a fish like me.
Trumpy Trout is an animatronic talking fish with a big personality.
I am the hugely bigliest fish in the pond.
I mean, I think it's kind of terrible on two levels. It's a terrible product. It's scary. I don't know. It's definitely terrible on that level. I'm torn on whether I think it's a good way to mock Trump. What do you think, Aaron?
Well, it's the thing. I'm not sure if it's even mocking Trump. I could see some Trump fans finding this endearing, you know, and that's why, you know, I have to say, you know, watching this ad, I was thinking of Kamala Harris's line, which she repeated multiple times throughout the speech, basically, because this was apparently really important to her and her aides to like hammer this campaign talking point home. But like, there's more that unites us than divides us.
Right.
Well, you know, if MAGA fans and if Kamala fans could both enjoy the Trumpy Trout, maybe this is an example of bringing the country together. So
you're right.
I'm going to salute these Trumpy Trout manufacturers for doing something that possibly can unite our divides right now in a very divided country.
Yeah. Well, you know what? This is, I got to admit, this is a first. We're making history. This is something I thought was an Isn't That Terrible, and it's actually Isn't That Uniting Our Country.
There we go.
There we go, yeah. Well, that has been your four basic food groups with a bonus category of Isn't That Bringing Our Country Together.
For this week's guest, we're going to talk about one of the top issues in the aftermath of the Trump-Kamala Harris debate, which is immigration. Trump said all these really offensive things about undocumented immigrants, and Kamala Harris responded by touting the endorsement of Dick Cheney. Like, that was her response to Trump claiming that people are eating pets. She said, well, Dick Cheney, I'm proud that Dick Cheney has endorsed me. And she also touted that she is just as hawkish as Trump when it comes to undocumented immigrants. So in our political spectrum, we don't really have much difference. So for a different take, we're going to speak this week to John Washington, who is a staff writer at Arizona Luminaria and the author of the recently released book, The Case for Open Borders. John Washington, thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
We're recording this in the aftermath of the first presidential debate between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, and everybody's talking about pets, namely Trump's allegation that undocumented immigrants or immigrants are eating pets in Springfield, Ohio, an allegation for which there is zero evidence, just a viral video of a mentally ill woman who's not an immigrant, who's actually American, being accused of harming a cat or maybe even eating a cat. But that woman's not Haitian, not an immigrant. And that appears to be the only basis for this viral and moronic claim that Trump made. So I'm just curious, after watching the debate, seeing the response to it, seeing the reaction, what are your thoughts on the way immigration was discussed in this debate between Trump and Harris?
I mean, it was hardly discussed, really. They, you know, bickered back and forth. But before we get into the debate, I think it's interesting to touch on what you led with there about these wild and false accusations, or very likely false accusations. And they are leveled at Haitian migrants. And that is something that I think is important, that and it shouldn't get lost. Haitians in particular, Haitian immigrants, have faced some of the most heinous vitriol in the history of U.S. immigration enforcement. You can trace that back a long way. Actually, the specifically anti-Haitian policies that have been put into effect over the last 40 some years have really driven and led the way for a lot of the worst of what we're seeing right now. The first usage of Guantanamo Bay as any sort of detainment center was used to detain Haitian migrants. Then in subsequent years, there was a number of orders under Bush 1 where they were actually deciding to push back Haitians at sea. And this was At that point, we had never really seen any sort of actual policy like this in the world. And now this is commonplace, and we see it regularly in the Mediterranean. We see it in the South Pacific with Australia using the same tactic to push back people who are trying to reach its shores and ask for asylum. And another fact here, I mean, there's so much history between U.S. and Haitian relations that we could get into, and especially how it, you know, has affected immigration policy. But one other thing that I think a lot of people sort of forget is the first immigration policy change after 9/11, and there were a lot, as we know, was to indefinitely detain Haitian migrants, that they were not allowed to be released without an express order and an individual order for each migrant. Why? Like, Haitians had zero to do with 9/11, as we all know, but they have been just the targets of this sort of anti-immigrant animus for decades at this point. And it's, I think, incredibly sad, and yet also no surprise at all that, again, when especially I think the Republicans are just grasping for anything to level at Democrats, that they have seized yet again on Haitians and have really made a just atrociously anti-human job of it. For the debate, unless we want to talk more about Haitians and the sort of development of some of the policies that led out of that.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it would be interesting to kind of contrast what Trump said, which were obviously over the top and offensive, right? There were two amazing moments during the debate, one where he talked about eating animals, one where he talked about giving aliens in jail transgender operations. But what about Kamala's policies, which I think something dangerous happens, which is that when you're debating Donald Trump or standing next to Donald Trump, everything you say kind of by contrast seems reasonable, but it's not necessarily that reasonable. So what do you think of what Kamala said during the debate?
I mean, she has wholeheartedly embraced policies that are to the right of where Trump was when he took office in 2016. You know, he said a lot of crap back then, 2015, 2016. But when you actually look at the policies that his administration early on was proposing, Kamala Harris now stands to the right of those policies. I was reading some commentary and someone made an astute point that she didn't talk about immigrants. She talked about drug smugglers, human traffickers, and, you know, people who illegally crossed the border. But she didn't even rely on like this idea of America as a nation of immigrants, which is like the most boilerplate standard go-to on the left, say, like to celebrate something that is, you know, a very much a false myth, but at least it's a little bit of, you know, nodding towards the humanity of people who are forced to flee and forced to, or decide to as well, to cross the U.S.-Mexico border or come to the United States in some other way. You know, the policies that she has now is fighting for are vehemently anti-immigrant. They would raise the asylum threshold. They would build more wall. They would put more surveillance technology on the U.S.-Mexico border. They would detain people for longer. You know, and I think it's also important to remember where we started. It wasn't that long ago, at the beginning of the Biden administration, the Biden-Harris administration, when that's not what they were saying. You know, they came into office in January of 2021 asking for a moratorium on deportations, a 100-day moratorium on deportations. How have they shifted so far to the right, not to the center at all? They've gone way past the center and are at the right. Also, right now, this is something that was a little bit of a news blip and not many people remember, but they actually, the most recent DHS appropriations bill, increased funding for more detention beds. So they have really ramped up the number of people who are currently detained in ICE facilities. And they are celebrating the fact that they work, that the government, that their administration is working hand in glove with private for-profit detention contractors. Again, let's remember where we came from, where they were singing a song on the campaign trail and in the early days in office saying they're going to end for-profit prisons. They never said it for migrants, but, you know, that was sort of something like, well, they're too involved. There's too many contracts right now. And, you know, I'm not excusing them, but I'm not surprised that they didn't say they were end for-profit immigration for immigrants. But now that they're celebrating for-profit detention for immigrants is a pretty sharp turn.
When Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone, he already had 3 missed calls from Chuck Norris.
We all know the man, the myth, and the legend of Chuck Norris. But did you know that in his 80s, he's still alive and kicking butt? Either that or death is too afraid to tell him the news. Chuck wants to share with you what gives him so much energy to work out, stay active, and keep up with his grandkids. He did this just by making one change. He says he still feels like he's in his 50s.
And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of 5-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/useful for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/useful.
This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy. Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health. Their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
It seems like the argument that you have to be tough on immigration in order to win elections is never really questioned. So I guess I have a 2-part question. One is, I mean, your book is called The Case for Open Borders. What is the case for open borders and how can people be deprogrammed? Because I have to admit, there are people who I'm kind of shocked by how much the language of an invasion and they're taking our jobs and comes from people who I would not describe as xenophobic or right-wing, or I wouldn't have thought of being that way. I think it's actually harder than the left wants to acknowledge for us to undo the argument that when people come and are exploited and work for lower wages, that hurts native-born Americans. So I know I'm throwing a lot at you, but I guess I'm asking you to kind of summarize your argument for those of us, we have read your book, but for those out there who haven't, summarize your argument about the case for borders and kind of explain to people why they should embrace this for not just moral reasons, but self-interested reasons.
Yeah. So I'll sort of start with a little background and try to answer the second part of that question. So I think, you know, one of the things I noticed for a long time, so I have been reporting on the border for over a decade now, and before that was involved with a lot of humanitarian aid work along the border. And, you know, my family also are migrants. And so I have this, I've always sort of known about border crossings and heard a lot about them. And one thing I noticed as I sort of, getting more involved was what a bad job borders do at actually keeping people out. And, you know, some people, of course, are pushed back. Some border enforcement or immigration enforcement measures work temporarily. But when you look at it, when you back up just a little bit and look at the actual big picture numbers, and you look at individual stories, you hear lots of anecdotes, and you realize that people get through, and they always have. You know, what borders do is they slow people down a little bit, and they make crossings more dangerous, sometimes more deadly, but they don't, you know, writ large actually stop people. So this is one thing that, you know, I noticed being on the ground, and then you do some research to try to corroborate that impression, and it holds not only along, you know, US-Mexico border or the other borders around the United States, but the borders in borders throughout the world. The other thing that I think is an important observation to kind of lead into this conversation is that, you know, I come from the left, and, you know, like a lot of the people who I associate with and was volunteering with were, you know, very much opposed to the Republicans or like the right wingers or even like the anti-immigrant policies of the Obama administration. And yet, you know, we can decry these inhumane tactics. But when I would ask people, so what then? Like, what's better? And the answer was absent in a lot of cases. And when it wasn't absent, it was muddled and kind of confusing. It's like, I didn't really hear, and I don't think we hear very much, what an alternate proposal is to this current system of closed borders, this growing system of increasingly locked down borders. And so this is sort of like one of the motivations of the book. And I think that this is, you know, the intro to this question you say about this, the actual strategic policy positions of maybe if we can kind of lean into some of like anti-immigrant sentiment, maybe we'll gain the political capital or something to pass a bill or pass a comprehensive immigration reform. But it doesn't work. And I think at this point, it's not only a problem of principle and the problem of politics, but I think it's also a problem of rhetoric. It's the way that the left now is scared to say what they believe in. They can only be on the defensive. It's just not, it's verboten to say in the Democratic Party that you want more people to come. You know, why? And here I'll start to get into the actual argument. And I ask why it's verboten. Because we know, if you look at studies, and these people who are saying, I mean, a lot of the politicians are not stupid. Some of them certainly are, but a lot of them are not. They know that they can look at studies and they read white papers. And they know that migration not only is good, but it's necessary. This point for the United States, that there are a host of essential industries for which there are a, you know, worrying shortage of workers, and that we cannot produce them quickly enough, naturally, in the United States. We need more workers here. And yet you listen to either side or any party really, and it's all keep them out, find new ways, creative ways to keep them out. But we need them. Like our economy would tank. And in fact, even though we have implemented all these anti-immigrant measures, we know that people are still coming and that, you know, even like the post-pandemic recession was mitigated in large part because of migrants. This is something that is not like secret, only talked about in academic circles. You know, like New York Times columnists write about this, and yet it doesn't get to the politicians, or it doesn't actually land in the national conversation. It's always anti-immigrant. We don't really understand, or we don't talk about how we understand actually how immigration works. And so I think another big thing here is, and this is something that I kind of wanted to come into the book, I didn't want to come into the book having to do, but since, you know, the book came out in February and I've had so many conversations about it, is it's almost more effective, I think, to try to direct and address the counter arguments, because there's so many and they're so knee jerk and just like basically automated at this point. Like, what about the jobs? You know, what about welfare services? Right. What about cultural change? What about security? What about crime? All of these things. And, you know, I won't take you listeners through all of them, but, you know, I spent a lot of time looking at serious scholarship, looking at, you know, economists who are nonpartisan or even were partisan and on the right. And if they are, you know, worth their fiscal salt at all and were actually doing a you know, legitimate or peer-reviewed study, they show that immigrants do not take jobs. That's not how it works. It's not a, like, national economics is not zero sum. We know this, that they actually create jobs, that they often raise wages or have a fairly neutral effect on wages. We know that statistics for crime rates in immigrant neighborhoods and, you know, crime statistics, crimes committed by immigrants are far lower than native born residents. That, you know, we have a couple centuries of seeing migrants, you know, pilloried for bringing in new foods and new smells and new whatever and languages, and yet they assimilate. You know, in fact, like, you look at some of the disgusting rhetoric spouted by New York City Mayor Eric Adams about how it was an existential threat that 100,000 Venezuelans were coming to New York City. You know, for good or for ill, immigrants built New York City, and we have these you know, celebrated, like, you know, ethnic enclaves sort of in New York right now, if they're not over gentrified. And this is something that is, like, identified and has made New York City one of the major metropolises in the world. Like, you know, all of these arguments, if you really actually take a hard look at them, they don't hold up. And so, to go a little bit, just briefly, to what is the positive argument? And here, I think one of the things that I think is a shame we don't talk enough about is, you know, we have over the last, say, century or so, fought hard as societies. Of course, we haven't won, but we've really tried to eliminate discrimination based on gender, based on race, based on religion, based on sexuality. And left out of that conversation is fighting against discrimination based on country of origin or birthplace. And, you know, why? That is an immutable characteristic, as are all of the rest. You can't do anything about where you were born, and yet you are relegated to, in many cases, extreme poverty, hardship, you know, violence, persecution. And if you try to move, then you could be arrested, indefinitely detained, tortured, excommunicated, killed. Like what? How is this okay? You know, I think it's absurd. And I think that, this is sort of my basic pitch, is that what is lacking, both on the left, I think generally, is a argument based on principles. All we do is argue about the politics of it. It's become a political football, and it has been for a long time at this point, but we aren't really stating our principles. And I think that, especially on the left, but everywhere, we need to embrace what we actually believe in. If you believe in, you know, fundamental freedoms, you can't leave migrants by the wayside. Like, that is a contradiction in morality. So I think we need to really just reckon with that. And it's something that, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, I can help sort of guide people through a little bit, look at those studies and sort of make this principled or moralistic argument, as what I try to do in the book.
What I think is lacking on the left as well, although recently we've seen some lawmakers speak up about it, is the fact that U.S. foreign policy deliberately creates migrants. If you destroy a country through murderous sanctions or through, you know, proxy wars, people are going to flee. And then we turn around and complain about people fleeing the results of our own policies. And I'm sorry to sound like a broken record for people who regularly watch U.S. Politics, but it's still like Kamala Harris was tasked to address the root causes of migration, but of course did not touch the critical U.S. role in creating migrants by knowingly decimating foreign countries. But how would you address someone like Bernie Sanders, who in 2015, maybe his views have changed since then, he famously said that basically open borders is a Koch brothers idea, and it's intended to basically flood countries with cheap labor from other countries in order to keep wages down for domestic workers, for, you know. And he even used a term that, where he sounded like Tucker Carlson. He said that, like, open borders makes countries poorer.
Yeah, that was disappointing. He did come around by the time he was campaigning in the primaries. He did reverse course on that. But I think that goes to, something that seems to be pretty much lacking right now is actually listening to constituents. And I think he kind of learned a lesson on it. But I think one thing that, one easy way to dispute that argument or that concern, which is really common, and it's something that I think is unfortunate that has been bandied about so much without doing a decent fact check on it, is look at what happened after NAFTA. NAFTA was like, this is 1994, and this was very early stages in putting any actual real infrastructure along the U.S.-Mexico border. Before that, there really wasn't border wall. There were some small segments around a couple different cities, but there were very few miles overall. And so what NAFTA did is it opened the economies of, United States, Mexico, and Canada, and it, had, as has been incredibly well documented, I'm sure most listeners have heard versions of the story, but it decimated very quickly a lot of the industries in Mexico, especially agriculture. And that was because of a flood of subsidized corn and all this other stuff. But we see some of the things I was talking about a little bit less about the effects in Mexico, in northern Mexico, in the maquila industry. So this is like basically modern day sweatshops in northern Mexico. So we saw productivity go up. Okay, fine. Well, for corporations, we saw wages actually go down in years immediately subsequent to NAFTA in northern Mexico. We saw unionization rates just plummet. And we saw overall numbers of employment go way up in that region. And that was because a lot of people from southern Mexico who lost their jobs or couldn't make it as small-time farmers anymore traveled north to Mexico, basically the first step for a lot of them to actually crossing the border. At the same time, in the U.S., what was already sort of becoming the Rust Belt, this is, where I grew up in Ohio, we saw 500,000 manufacturing jobs lost in a short period of time. And where did a lot of those go? Exactly what we were just talking about, to northern Mexico. So what did closed borders do to both economies? It devastated them. It made, some of the corporate elite a little bit more money and align their pockets a bit more. But actually for the common worker, it had the opposite effect. And I think that is the sort of trend that we're seeing, we have been seeing since then. And so I think just reminding Bernie or someone else who makes that argument of this very clear piece of the historical record, be like, oh, but that's not how it works, actually. Closed borders make folks lose jobs on both sides, because the people who can offshore or nearshore will do so, because on the other side of the border, we have an immobilized or partially immobilized population that is willing to accept jobs for far lower wages. And that is still happening. I mean, it's not just happening along the U.S.-Mexico border. It's happening in Central America. What was Kamala's response to becoming this person who's going to address the root causes of migration from Central America?
Do not come.
Which is like, it would be silly if it weren't offensive, but she also really tried to ramp up corporate development in Central America. And just like, read a history book, like that has not gone well ever. This is not the way to boost an economy. This is a way to further immiserate more people. And I think, whatever, my position would be just like hands off Central America. I mean, maybe reparations would be one thing, just like money that could be potentially actually distributed, but hands off, because, we do not have I don't think we properly understand what actually development aid goes to. And if it does go to the right people, these folks who want migrants to stay out of the country are shooting themselves in the foot, because there's, you know, maybe not that intuitive reality of when people migrate. And the poorest people in the world are not the ones who migrate. Migration costs money. And so the folks who are in abject poverty in the highlands of Guatemala are not the ones that usually go, because you effectively need to pay for a smuggler at this point, because even if you somehow don't and try to make it into Mexico, there'd probably be multiple attempts. It costs a lot. So there's actually a threshold that of finances that needs to be met for someone to actually migrate. So if you're able to pull people up in some of the most poor countries in this hemisphere or elsewhere out of that like extreme level of poverty, you'll see more people start moving, which, you know, I don't think is a bad thing, but I just think like we're not having a real conversation where we actually look at the effects of this. So yeah, I don't think that Kamala Harris has any like provable record on pausing or slowing down migration. Of course, Central Americans are moving at slightly lower rates now, but that's for many and complicated reasons, including Mexican crackdowns, including slight changes in Central American politics right now. But I couldn't point to a single policy change that Kamala did that actually had any effect.
So what do you say? I'm sorry to return to this argument, but I mean, I'm thinking of this just practically in terms of the people I encounter. What do you say to people who say, oh, why should I, who embrace the zero-sum game, right? And say, why should I suffer? Like, I feel bad for these people. Maybe the United States created the conditions that makes their immigrating here necessary. Maybe they're fleeing terrible stuff, but why should I take it? Like, why should it come at my expense?
Yeah. I mean, it's really hard to have those conversations. And I frequently find that I don't get anywhere. I don't think people are primed to listen at this point. They've been, I think, instilled with so much fear from, you know, generations of politicians at this point that I there's not many folks who really seem, I mean, some, but there's, I frequently encounter people who just can't have the conversation. And it you know, often quickly sort of takes a turn into the absurd where they'll bring up a talking point about like tens of or hundreds of thousands of sex trafficked kids. And you're just like, wait, what? Like, where are we? Like, can we not just like talk in plain terms about this issue? But, you know, if I were able to sit down and have a calm conversation with someone about that, you know, I think I would try to walk them through, like, actually, you know, wherever you live, almost certainly existentially depends on immigrant labor, on more migrants coming. I mean, where I am in Arizona, the ranchers in southern Arizona, a lot of them are right wingers. A lot of them will probably, you know, cast their ballots for Trump. But they also know that if they don't get cheap labor from northern Mexico, they cannot ranch. You know, Phoenix would not be the weird, unsustainable metropolis it is right now without migrant roofers and migrant plumbers and like all of these people and migrant, you know, also doctors and migrant, you know, they are so interwoven into every facet of our society that, you know, I guess one is like trying to remove them would be devastating. And two is like, there are so many gaps where we actually need more people. And that, you know, there also have been studies that are like counter studies that have been done showing the cost of deportation. And even in times of crisis. So there's one study I found when doing the research right after the Great Depression, there was the Mexican Repatriation Act that was passed. I think it was in 1930. And this was like just flailing politicians like, oh my gosh, like, you know, obviously like a very real depression was happening. And they thought like removing laborers would actually help. But there are some like really interesting studies that have shown that even from small towns in like the Midwest or the Plain States, where a lot of people were removed from, those towns suffered more than neighboring towns or from, you know, comparable towns in different parts of the country. So deportation costs a lot of money. And also it then has cascading and negative effects on your own native born worker job. So yeah, you know, it's the problem is like I think the ideal or the left or what I would hope to be the left's argument here doesn't fit on a bumper sticker. You can't hold up a sign at the DNC that would be the counterpoint to mass deportations now? What would it be? I guess you could. It could be open borders now, but I don't think that's quite politically feasible because it is complicated. In some sense, like the right has an easier time with it. They're like, no more people. That's it. We don't want it. And the left's like, well, actually we need, and it's just too complicated. It's not sloganizable or something.
One of the points you make in your book is that undocumented immigrants make a huge contribution to society, but get basically no benefits from it. They get nothing back from what they contribute. Can you talk to us about that?
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiotspodcast.com.
That was a great interview, and that was a great book. I really suggest that people get that book. It's a really fascinating read. It goes through lots of interesting historical issues that we didn't really get time to even talk about. Relates the border issue to the issues of colonialism and conquest. So yeah, and definitely if you're not already members, please become a member at usefulidiotspodcast.com so you can see the full interview with John, and we ask him about Gaza.
And his book again is called The Case for Open Borders. So check it out. Thanks for joining us. We appreciate your support. We'll see you next time.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. If you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at Useful Idiot Pod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.